In November 1999, members of the World Trade Organization convened in Seattle to negotiate trade agreements for the new millennium. But their talks quickly were overwhelmed by some 40,000 protesters who filled the streets, condemning globalization, corporate power, and the potential impacts of free trade on human rights and the environment.
And we are not afraid!
I'm Knute Berger, Crosscut's editor-at-large. I was in Seattle then. I covered the protests on the streets.
Firing tear gas and spraying pepper spray at us.
I remember what a big deal it was, the so-called battle in Seattle.
The bank window here at US Bank. We gotta get out of here.
The anarchists were a tiny fraction of the thousands who marched on Seattle, but they were a catalyst.
The whole world is watching! The whole world is watching!
Not only a fight for one day or 2 days, the fight for many years.
On November 19th, I'll moderate a conversation with some of the people at the center of the action in 1999. Including John Sellers, co-founder of The Other 98% and board president of the Ruckus Society, and Norm Stamper, Seattle's police chief at the time. Looking back 20 years later, we'll discuss what the battle in Seattle can teach us about who we are, where we've been, and where we're going. Please join us.
For more information about this event, go to crosscut.com/events.
Okay, on with the show.
Hello and welcome to Crosscut Talks, a podcast replay of Crosscut's live interviews with the people who shape our world. I'm Mark Bumgarten, the managing editor at Crosscut. The financial side of the news business has been struggling for decades now. And 2019 has been an especially bad year. Downsizing and closures continue across the country. BuzzFeed, Vice, and Huffington Post all announced major layoffs in recent months, and at least a dozen local news outlets have either eliminated positions or folded completely. And here in Seattle, where there is only one major daily newspaper left, City Arts Magazine and Seattle Weekly both recently ended their print runs. Is there any hope left for the business of journalism? Crosscut gathered a panel of Seattle media leaders to weigh in. Jill Jackson is news director at the Seattle public radio station KUOW. After launching her career as a KUOW intern, she spent a decade reporting in Washington, D.C. for NPR and Public Radio International. She then switched to TV news, producing and running national shows including CBS This Morning and CBS's Face the Nation. Yvonne Terziski is the director of digital media for King 5, a TV station based in Seattle. She focuses on the station's online and social media presence, as well as audience engagement, and uses data and metrics to help drive editorial choices. Christopher Chan is a visual anthropologist and head of content at Cut.com, a video storytelling outlet based in Seattle that's gotten a lot of national attention. He is also a PhD candidate and instructor in anthropology at the University of Washington. His research focuses on content, capitalism, and audience attention in the digital entertainment industry. Crosscut executive editor Victor Hernandez moderated the discussion. This conversation is sponsored by Comcast, WeWork, and Mike and Becky Hughes. It was recorded on May 4th, 2019 at Seattle University as part of the Crosscut Festival.
Thank you. Good morning. Good morning, everyone. How are you? All right. Fantastic. Crosscut Festival. We are here. My name is Victor Hernandez. I'm the new executive editor of Cascade Public Media, home to KCTS9 and Crosscut News. I recently arrived just 2.5 months ago and to the organization and to Seattle, and I'm incredibly excited to join the mission-driven team performing important public interest journalism and in doing so from one of the most vibrant and fast-growing regions of the country. Just by way of a little background on myself, being the new arrival here to the area, I will just outline that I've spent about the past 2 decades working in newsrooms from local broadcast stations in the great state of California, where I'm originally from, continuing on to CNN's global headquarters in various leadership roles for a dozen years, most recently working in the areas of media innovation for a fast-growth technology startup based out of Silicon Valley, and also very recently with the Missouri School of Journalism in Columbia, Missouri. I currently serve as a national board member on the Society of Professional Journalists and also a longtime member with the Online News Association and the National Association of Hispanic Journalists. So in short, I am very much committed to journalism and innovation and excited to be with you this morning. I'm honored to moderate today's panel examining issues pertaining to the rapidly changing local media landscape. I'd like to welcome the panel and ask for brief introductions from our speakers, perhaps sharing a brief thumbnail on your backgrounds and current role. Chris?
All right, hi everybody. First of all, thank you for coming so early this morning. It's really refreshing to see people full house at 9 a.m. So my name is Christopher Chan. I'm the director of content at Cut.com. I'm also a visual anthropologist in the Department of Anthropology, so I also teach and study at the University of Washington. My research is about the relationship between content, capitalism, and human intention. And I do that research and that field work by working at Cut with my colleagues. We're basically 23 people in a tiny barn rehabbed in Lower Queen Anne that somehow managed to get 400 million views a month. And I don't think that has anything to do with our ingenuity or anything like that, but rather it's just a sign of the times that we live in. And I'm really looking forward to this conversation, so thank you for having me.
He wins the cool factor. I'm Jill Jackson. I'm the news director at KUOW. I started as an intern at KUOW in 2003 and then moved out to Washington, D.C., covered Congress for public radio stations all over the country, and then moved to CBS to produce on Capitol Hill for CBS Evening News, 60 Minutes, CBS This Morning. I then moved over to the management side, working, running our morning coverage in the D.C. Bureau for CBS, and then worked at Face the Nation for 3 years. And then I came home, and I'm so excited to be here. Seattle is an amazing news town, so it's been great to be back for the past year and a half.
My name is Yvonne Trzuski. I'm the director of digital media at King 5. I also started as an intern. When I started in 1982, there was no digital. So you probably realize, hi, Mike James, how are you? I worked with him. You probably realize we also have a TV station. It's called King 5. I'm sure you all watch it, and if you don't, you should. I specialize in the digital platforms, but I also specialize in audience. We have a lot of metrics who show what our audience wants and needs from us, and it's really important that we pay attention to those metrics. I spend a lot of time on social media interacting with our audience. This is really important. We're going to talk about it today. Like Christopher, I work out of a really cool building, kitty corner from the T-Mobile Park down in SoDo. If you haven't seen it down there, it's a really lively neighborhood. I'm really excited to be here and listen to all of you, too.
Well, this is a complex topic, folks. I gather that's why many of you are here today. And so I am, again, very excited and honored to be joined here by a powerhouse crew of thought leaders across the local media landscape. And we're going to dive right in and start with some real easy stuff, right? Because this topic isn't heady as it is. But we're going to jump right in. And I would ask the panel to chime in on some thoughts. As we all know, local newspapers have closed around the country. More and more communities are left with no daily news outlet at all. These described news deserts have resulted in adverse effects for the local community by way of dramatically reduced coverage in terms of politics, the economy, education, health, and other important societal issues. This means much less awareness of these issues, oversight and accountability of government agencies, and a real hit to civic engagement. And this isn't just rural America we're talking about with regard to these news deserts. Just last month, the Cleveland Plain Dealer announced dramatic cutbacks to the editorial staff, reducing their headcount to an astonishing 10% of where that newsroom was just 20 years ago. And just 2 days ago, the New Orleans Times-Picayune announced that they are facing adverse cutbacks, massive cutbacks in a merger with another local paper there. This will equate to many job losses within the local journalism community in that industry. So we're still seeing many, I would say that in Seattle, we are not immune to this. This is happening elsewhere, big cities and small rural areas, and Seattle is not immune to this contention of slowed growth, staff reductions, and in some cases, outright shutdowns. So for the panel, again, starting off easy, right? Is Seattle immune to this news desert trend? What are local outlets doing to ensure the local landscape remains somewhat intact or sustainable? And what more can readers and audiences do to support local news sources? Yvonne, can we start with you?
Well, first of all, I don't see them in the room, but boy, I'm going to give a big shout out to Tracy Record and Patrick Sand. If you know who they are, they run the West Seattle blog, and they are doing something that we need more of. They're working out of their home, they're covering that community, they're doing it in partnership with their neighbors, and they have set the model for hyper-local journalism. For a while, they sort of inspired some other local blogs around. We still have some in existence. I think there's my Queen Anne, we used to have My Ballard. I don't think Seattle is necessarily in jeopardy of becoming a news desert because of people like Tracy and Patrick. However, we've seen the demise of the Seattle PI. When I was a kid, we got the newspaper in the morning and the afternoon. But then we see things like what Christopher's doing and what Jill are doing, what Victor's doing here. And I think what's crucial here is that all of us in the media have to say, we're going to do this together. We're going to partner with other media organizations. We're not going to be necessarily thinking about this as a competitive landscape. We're going to be thinking about this as an opportunity. I mean, we partnered with KUOW to provide debates during the last Seattle mayoral campaign. We did Facebook Live so our audience could ask questions of the candidates. I think we just need to look at opportunities to work on this together to serve our community. And I would suggest that all of you in the audience take a look at what the Seattle Times is doing with the Seattle Foundation. They're trying to raise $500,000 to continue their amazing investigative work. We don't have a paywall at King, probably never will, but we do have ads. So hopefully you forgive us for that and you get through to our content. But I think, as long as the public supports the media and partners with the media to help us provide better storytelling and better coverage, I think we're okay here.
I agree. I think collaboration is definitely the way to go. I think in Seattle, where I feel there's kind of a vacuum is in our arts coverage. We at KOW are very lucky to have Marcy Silman, but she's one of a really small handful of journalists covering the arts in this town. City Council, David Croman does an amazing job for Crosscut covering City Council. But I can tell you, our reporters at KOW, everyone kind of owns a little piece of the City Council. Like our homelessness reporter will follow the homelessness issues going on in the council, but we don't have someone down there every day. And having covered Congress and worked out of the Capitol building, I feel like it's so important to have someone just there all the time to hold the powerful people accountable and to just. If you're there, you're going to get the stories and you're going to get the scoops. But I do think, I completely agree that through collaboration with other news organizations, I mean, we were talking on our way over here about what we might be able to do for 2020. We're talking with other news organizations about how we might be able to beef up our arts coverage. I think that is definitely the key. I also would just add quickly that one thing that I do think is also sort of filling the vacuum right now is Nextdoor. Like, are you going to a news site to figure out what's going on right now in your neighborhood, or are you going to Nextdoor? And that is something I'm a little nervous about. yes, because there are a lot of assumptions made on the front end that don't have to adhere to the ethics that we do in journalism.
Mm. Just to echo a couple of these comments here, to the question, which is whether we live in a whether we're at risk of living in a news desert. I don't think we are. Like, as you both mentioned, like, we have a very committed and engaged population here that is both information hungry, but also participatory. Like, as an anthropologist, like, I read these community blogs or these hyper-local blogs, and I do read Nextdoor in a very curious, observational way. And what we see is that they're actually everyday people are willing to be co-producers or co-creators of the news. The anthropologist in me, of course, is like so interested in reading the comments. And I think that's like this opportunity we have for this kind of co-production or collaboration, not just between media organizations, but between everyday people and media makers and newsmakers. And I think that's something really particular to hear in this place on Earth, and really exciting, and gives me a little bit of hope to this larger question about whether the news is broken. So
that's terrific. I want to keep the thoughts going around sustainability. Before I do, I want to take a second and just remind everyone the conversation continues beyond this room on social media, the hashtag CrossCutFest. So please feel free to share, add, use the Slido app as well to present questions toward the end. Coming back to sustainability, I'd like to do a bit of an experiment in the room, or at least just a display around a show of hands in the audience. Who is currently, or perhaps recently over the past year, financially supported local journalism? You've subscribed to a product. That's a good majority. That's awesome. Obviously, attending events like this weekend is a big, you know, a obvious way, an important way to support your local news outlets. Those of you that paid for a ticket and didn't go with the comp, thank you. Thank you, everyone, for being here. But where I'm going with this is there does seem to be a bit of a divide, a significant divide, actually, between public perceptions of the health and the state of media in this country, particularly local, and what's actually going on, which is a very much a transformative period of disruption and upheaval. And we just talked about some of the staff reductions or outright shutdowns and leading to news deserts. So according to a new Pew Research study on local news, most Americans actually believe local news media are doing fairly well financially. 71%, in fact, according to this Pew study, thought that the state of local media was doing fine. And further, few are very willing to actually pay for local news, some 14%. So those numbers really seem out of whack in terms of what's actually happening on the ground in newsrooms and throughout these organizations. So my question for the panel is, where do we think these sort of the divide between perception and reality comes from? What could and should news operations be doing to help audiences better understand and potentially support, pay for quality journalism in an age where so many are going under? Jill, do you want to take a stab at that one?
It's tricky. Everyone's kind of asking that question. And with each pledge drive that we have at KOW, you probably hear us talking about different things. We try to explain sort of the real cost of doing business, which is high. That NPR programming doesn't come for free. KOW pays them for it. We have, in some ways, in transparency of what it takes to make something that, I'll use our podcast as an example at KOW. I mean, there's kind of a joke that everyone has a podcast. Anyone can make a podcast, low barrier to entry. But to make a good podcast, it's incredibly expensive. You need talent. You need an editor. You need a full-time, not necessarily full-time, depends on how much you're putting out onto the podcast. But you need a host, at least one host. You need an editor. You need a producer. There are many people involved. You need equipment. And sometimes people with special skills like soundscaping to make it sound cool. None of that is free. You actually have to, a lot of people have bad podcasts. So kind of trying to explain what goes behind the work that people are able to just easily access on their phone or easily stream. I mean, it, it's expensive. But it's also, we tried different things, like in the lead up to our last pledge drive. Talked a lot about our radioactive program at KOW, where we're actually like building and training the next generation of journalists and trying to leave a legacy behind us, that your money is going towards that. So kind of trying to find, make it really clear what you're donating to. But one problem with that is that you are talking to your current audience. If you really want to grow your donor base or funding, you need to do things like what KOW has done, which we started a whole marketing, they had a 5-year plan, rapid growth. They created a marketing team. They did a big KOW brand awareness campaign this summer. And that's so new, and it's sometimes really uncomfortable for public radio employees, because we're not used to, that's like something that you do in the corporate world, right? But with the surveys that have been done, it's amazing how few people actually in this town even know what KOW is. And so to get the word out, to promote KOW and the work that we're doing, it's, you're having to do some new marketing practices.
So Yvonne, it's a different story for a commercial broadcast station in which you're leading digital in terms of the things that Jill and I, our teams, are associated with, leaning on the audience relationship, being supported through pledge donations and memberships and drives and such. It's a different sort of revenue stream existence there. For your universe, is how does the public support what you're doing? How do they help advance and move forward and grow your newsroom? Is it clicking ads? Is that, what is the direct way in for them to get behind what your teams are doing?
So I'm gonna look like at my glasses up there, so you can jump in at any time to help me out.
Jim Rose, our general manager. We do a lot of different things. We do the traditional ads that you all see when you log in or when you watch your linear TV signal. But just like we're trying to be more collaborative with our audience, we're trying to be more collaborative with our business partners. And so we have several initiatives going where they might sponsor particular initiatives that we're doing. We do some content creation in connection with some of our more robust and, you know, bigger business partners. We're always thinking, what else can we do? And we're always talking. I talk to the digital sales director all the time. He'll say to me, when T-Mobile Park switched over from Safeco Field, he said, you know, I'm talking to them. They want to know, can we put a countdown clock on our website to, you know, when the new ballpark's going to open? Can they sponsor it? And I said, yes, they can do that. So a lot of this is kind of unobtrusive, and I think it's sort of, you're kind of used to it now. A lot of the audience members are used to it. But if I see advertising on the site that I think is like interfering with the audience's experience, I'll call them up and I'll say, or I'll email them and say, hey, Jason, this isn't working for me. Can we fix this? So we work together, because ultimately we want to serve our audience. And part of that is having our business partners also serve you in a way that still allows you to get our great content. So hopefully that's helpful.
Sure.
Jim, did you want to add anything?
I would say briefly, because I'm not on the panel. I think there's this belief system that an ad-supported journalism venture has a tougher time of it. I don't believe that to be true, because in this particular town, fantastic investigative journalism and journalism period does support growth in audience. And if we can grow our audience by providing sound, fantastic journalism, the revenue will follow. And that goes for what we do on the linear TV signal, as well as what we do on the digital side of our business, and it is paying dividends. So sometimes people believe ad-supported journalism ventures and great journalism sometimes impede one another. That's not the case.
Christopher, what are you guys seeing at Cut.com? How are things shaking out in terms of revenue and where you see the future going?
Yeah, so we are also in this highly uncertain topography, like everybody else. I think maybe more pronounced because we have no reputation nor history. We are about 4 years old. We had just... has anybody here heard of that adpocalypse thing? Show of hands. This is... Okay, so there's a couple of you. But In the way, recently, in the wake of a couple controversies on YouTube, namely like Hamas funding some operations using its content, but also PewDiePie saying some sort of neo-Nazi-ish comments, we've seen a complete pullback from advertisers in this duopoly in the advertising marketplace between Facebook and Google, which owns and operates YouTube. Okay, and it's one of the most repressive advertising regimes that I can ever think of in recent history, actually. So we worry constantly about advertising revenue, and it's not sustainable. We acknowledge and understand that, like, we cannot build our business around that. So one thing we try to think about is how to build authentic and rewarding relationships between our audience members and us so that they feel like we're providing them value. And we find that 0.001% of that audience is willing to actually pay for it. Go figure, and that actually can sustain a business.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's just is a numbers game, that tiny percentage of people that are willing to support you can actually, it can pencil out.
Well, in recently arriving to Seattle and learning about the local media ecosystem and who's getting a ride and where there's some interesting experiments and being turned on to Cut.com, the only question I have now is, who is the genius in your operation that came up with the idea for the video, Grandmas Smoke Weed for the First Time? If you've not seen it, it's got about 10 billion views on YouTube, and it is impossible to not finish the video in its entirety because it is that riveting as these three grandmothers are getting hammered. That was really fun. And these are the things this seems to be the business of where you find these viral experiences and they really take off online.
Right. I wish I could claim ownership of that idea, but I didn't. I did not. I didn't find the grandmas either. But I find it funny. Like, we made that video and had a tremendous viral success because I think it used a genre that is really vernacular that everyday people are really familiar with, the viral video. But that we present it in a way that is a little bit different, I think. And in a weird way, that video ended up in all of these discourses about legalization, about prohibition of marijuana. It ended up in Michael Moore's documentary. It ended up in Newsweek in the cover story. And so that's just like another anecdote for how these small things end up in the zeitgeist.
I want to take a couple of minutes and maybe do a quick roundup of a rapid fire of technology and the role it plays within media organizations today, but most importantly, as we advance forward. And of course, the backdrop here in Seattle being a great technological mecca of sorts, we get to live and work in a leading edge tech marketplace. We know that one of the primary staples important to journalism over the last decade or so has really been emerging media, new innovation. So I'm interested in your perspectives in terms of what excites you about the role of technology in connecting with audiences, specific pathways that you're making longer term investments toward the future on, maybe what your newsrooms are preparing for next, and what are the frontiers that seem to present the bigger short and long term opportunities. Who wants to go first on that, Jill?
I'll start. Gosh, there are a lot of questions packed in there for rapid fire. Okay, I'll start. So the wonderful thing, there are so many things. So first of all, our environment reporter, John Ryan, just did a feature for us traveling from California to Seattle by rail to sort of show how you can do a lower carbon footprint type trip. And he reported the entire thing on his phone, which back when I started in radio, it's like you had all the thing, all the equipment, all the, you know, the Marantz, this big thing, all that. I mean, how easy you can report anytime, anywhere. You don't need your kit anymore. This is the microphones with each phone generation just get better and better. So that's just in terms of reporting out there. But also, I mean, we have this ability to reach new audiences now through technology. We have a whole smart speaker strategy in terms of people listening on their smart speakers. You have podcasting exists because of the pod, you know, you've got your podcasting platforms on here, which I would say, you know, everyone's been declaring radio dead or broken or on its way out forever, but we, you know, many people agree we're in a new kind of golden age of audio now, of mm-hmm. audio listening. So, and that's in large part due to technology. And I think it's what it's doing is shifting things a bit. I mean, you're no longer necessarily always getting that driveway moment on All Things Considered, but you are getting it here, and you're getting this longer form, in-depth reporting that, like, we have our podcast Primed, which is all about Amazon and how it's changing life as we know it. And we wouldn't have time to go in the depth that we are on the radio. So we're able to do it here. It's changing how we report, where we're reporting, who we're reaching, and the depth that we're able to go. So I see a lot of promise.
Quick question, another show of hands, please, for the audience. Who here has listened to a podcast in the last week? Wow, okay, so again, the vast majority. Thank you, curious and box checked. Yvonne, how about you?
Well, I'm gonna hop on the mobile thing, right?
Please.
The great thing about mobile is, to me, I didn't see this at first, but I see it now, is that you, the members of the audience, can really have a lot of control over your experience. You did before when we just had the desktop, but you really now can decide, because it's always with you, and if it's not, you panic, like me, and like, where's my phone, and it's in your hand. You know, how many of us have done that, right? So you have a lot of control over your news consumption experience or your content consumption experience. My team, which is a digital producing team, we don't produce for the desktop, we produce for mobile, because two-thirds of our audience on any given day is either accessing through our app or our mobile site. And on the weekends, it goes way up. So I was like, what's that going to look like? What's that going to look like? What's that going to look like? And we have a really strong, robust local content strategy on digital. So if you were to open our app now, what you would really see is front and center is four stories. And 99.9% of the time, those are local stories. And often they are investigative stories, because we know that you can go anywhere for national news. You can, you know, go anywhere for commodity content. But we want you to come to us for this content that you can only get from a local media provider. And by the way, I would encourage you to download our app. And if you don't do it today, do it in a couple months, because we're redesigning it to make it even better for you. And I think I can say that now, because it's beautiful and I've seen it. It's awesome. The other thing that I think is really, and I'm going to use the F word.
Uh-oh.
And I mean Facebook. Okay. What? Yeah, exactly. You know, is it a frenemy? You know, is it friend or foe? But I will say that one thing that Facebook has really helped us as a media company do is actually have real-time conversations and with our audience. And as we saw during the mayoral debates, our audience at home in their pajamas drinking a cup of coffee or a beer were able to participate in these debates. And we've recently been doing a series on the declining local orca population. I'm sure we're all familiar with that. And our environmental reporter, Allison Morrow, is bringing together experts. The first week it was all about salmon population, because it's so crucial to the southern resident killer whales. And last week we did one on pollution. And the one coming up is about boat noise. And our audience is able to, you really put these experts on the spot in real time through a Facebook Live. And I think that's really powerful. I know that Victor has another question about Facebook, so I'm not going to go any further down that road. But tapping into these, like bringing your audience into the experience in real time, can really make your content so much more meaningful and better. So, you know, we need to look at technology that way, is how does it make it better? Ultimately, it always starts with your content, but, you know, the technology is partners with getting that out to the people who are most interested in it.
Chris, what you bet.
So I know we're running out of time, so I'm going to be really fast. So I'll say, like, I think it's really easy for us to get caught in this trap where we talk about technology as a kind of monolith. Well, we really ought to think about these constituent technologies that are made in certain times and places by certain actors with different motivations. So this search algorithm is made in this city in California by these people with these certain profit motivations or whatever. This hardware technology is advanced in Korea for whatever reasons. I'm really interested in the work of Safiya Noble. She wrote this book called Algorithms of Oppression. right, which really questions and challenges us about the Google search algorithm, which we think of as neutral, which we think of as progressive and futuristic, but actually carries with it certain 19th century logics about, say, race. Her interest was in how the Google image search animalizes or sexualizes black women's bodies or black men's or black children's bodies in comparison to white people's bodies. And so, like, in the 21st century, in, you know, from the Google headquarters, we have produced this tool that uses human logics and it updates them without really revising some of its problems. And so I would just say, I would urge us, I think, as media professionals, to just consider how these technologies re-inscribe certain things that we would never want to be associated with. I think the thing that, the opportunity, if I could just say real fast, the thing that really excites me about technology really has to do with the audience. And my audience, it can be as young as 9 years old. This is a generation of people that are actually very savvy about media, very conscious and cognizant about the way that they're targeted, about the way that their demographic profile is shaped. They're very savvy about flouting it and doing sorts of these trickstery maneuvers around these algorithms and other modes of audience observation. And that actually really excites me. I think that's like the thing I'm looking forward to, is the landscape of this audience that actually actively understands how they're being targeted.
I think we've got time for one more of my questions, and then we're going to get to audience questions. So be sure and use the Slido app if you haven't already put yours together in there. But I wanted to take a couple of minutes and just address the topic of audience trust. And, you know, we live in an age with misinformation all around us. And, you know, media ethics are as important now as they've ever been. You know, things like media literacy are just critically important to that publisher, programmer, back into audience community relationship. So to that point, confidence in the media has hit rock bottom, with many news consumers believing that reporters file the reports before knowing the facts, and 60% of people are under the impression that sources pay for stories, according to a depressing new survey of American journalism by the Columbia Journalism Review. So for the panel, with regard to audience trust, media literacy, and misinformation, what can news organizations do? What are you guys doing to stem the tide, return public perceptions back toward the positive, or is it just the fact that we will forever now be judged only by our last viral post? Chris, do you want to jump on that with your great background from anthropology and begin to...
Sure. You know, I don't actually have much more to say than what I think everybody here has already said, this idea that transparency is possible. And I think that so much of... You know, I'm not a journalist, so I shouldn't even be commenting about this, but my observation would be that journalism's practices and its methods get kind of black boxed, and they're not legible or retrievable to the audience until something goes wrong, right? And it's in that moment that they begin to think about the way that reporting happens. And so, like, you know, I think all of our work as media makers might just be to be really transparent and make accessible the ways that we produce journalism.
I think I have a couple quick thoughts on that. One, I think we always have to, we can never think that we got it right, that we've got, that we're safe. I have been having conversations with one of our editors this week. We were just chatting about, like, what are some things we could do to, like, be more transparent about how this story was made? What are some things we could do to make sure we check all the boxes before we hit publish and check those every single time? And then also, I see Ross Reynolds is here. He works in our community engagement department at KOW, and they are actively working all the time to see how we can engage with the community, bring them into the work that we do, get feedback from the audience and the community on the work that we do, get feedback on how we might be able to do things better next time to sort of increase, not only preserve the trust, but increase the trust between KOW and the community. So I think that it's both in your process that you have that should be very clear in terms of fact-checking and making sure that all sides have been heard in the story, but then also actively going into the community and not necessarily bringing the truth from on high, but having it be a conversation.
Yvonne, anything to add? You good?
I think, again, we're talking a lot about audience. I think it's just important that they know, and you're some of them, and sometimes I'm some of them, that we're listening. So I try to make it a point that every email that comes to my team gets answered, and all they really care about most of the times is that we heard them. Sometimes I can't really deliver what they're asking for, but we get so many emails back saying, wow, I can't believe you responded. And to have our journalists go into, again, Facebook, because that's where people are, and listen to the comments on their stories and respond. I think it's so important that we make it so clear that we're partners with our community and our audience. And the best way to do that is to start by listening and then responding. And part of that, too, is sometimes admitting you've made a mistake. And I'm going to echo here, too. We hear a lot about transparency, but every day we have to say, okay, how can we pull back the curtain more? I think we can always do a better job at it. We can always put more editor's notes or be a little bit more transparent when we're presenting something on a TV newscast. And, you know, internally in our newsroom, and we do this a lot, and it's actually pretty good. We're like poking at each other. We're questioning each other. Are you sure? Are you ready? Do we really want to do that? You know, how did this happen? That type of thing. And sometimes it can make us a little uncomfortable, but that's good. It's good to be uncomfortable sometimes. So.
All right. Well, now is a great time to fire up some questions, and so we are going to utilize technology and see the gems that are being presented by this savvy audience. And so I am going to just rapid fire. We'll go through as many of these as we can, folks. But let's come back to things like Nextdoor and Facebook with the first question. So for the panel, how can readers and consumers trust the accuracy of hyper-local blog content to avoid them perpetuating what we've seen on Nextdoor and Facebook? I mean, I think we were kind of getting to a lot of that in the last couple of questions, but you think there's anything there that hasn't been shared?
Well, I would just say, you know, like my first reaction to that is because it's hyperlocal, because it's based in the community, and because the comment section on those platforms are just a little bit more legible than some other comment sections, that people actually immediately are holding each other accountable and doing that kind of fact-checking on the ground. They just may not have the formal training to do so and are developing the media literacy to do that. But that would be my response. Mm.
I think, though, that there is a danger there because who do you believe? So, I mean, I would actually, there's some post on Nextdoor that I was looking at that I, where someone had said that their dog got sick, had basically practically overdosed from drugs at Magnuson Park and went to the vet, and the vet was saying, this is an epidemic. And then you go into the comment section and people are like, there is no way. That's not true. And other people saying, well, that happened to my dog and blah, blah, blah. So you got, who do you believe? So then I think you need to take it that next step further of like, okay, who did the local blog, who did they contact to kind of referee and who bringing in someone with some kind of knowledge and authority who can speak on the subject to kind of give you the truth. Because often, sometimes with Nextdoor, I'll be sitting there like, I don't know, you know?
I would say my Nextdoor, I gotta admit, it's pretty white. I live on the east side, but one thing that I see my city doing is they're in there all the time. Like, isn't that cool? Like, they're going in there, and, you know, we have some controversies going on around building a couple shelters for homeless populations, and you know, people are talking about it, and the city of Bellevue goes in there and you know, talks about the progress and all of that. And, like, wouldn't that be great if government agencies went in there and maybe helped be more transparent and kind of fight a little bit of this misinformation? I mean, the interesting thing about Nextdoor is everybody's is different, and every day it's different. But you can also get a lot of great feel for your own community, which you can, you know, like in our newsroom, it's like if you all looked at Nextdoor every day, think of all the great story ideas we could go through, you know? I think the potential is really big.
One of my recommendations on Twitter, if you do use Twitter, I highly recommend following Best of Next Door. Yeah. It's incredibly entertaining, because if you think things are wild and interesting and around your corner, this is a curation of some really outlandish posts from Next Door. So check out Best of Next Door. I want to get to a really interesting question from Patrick in the audience, who asks, does viral success equate to sound journalism? Does popularity take the place of objective information? And what does this do for professional journalism? And I think, having now been within my current newsroom at Crosscut for the last couple of months, these are things we all wrestle with, right? It's hard to scale viral. You guys are making a valiant attempt, and so we're following that closely. But we're doing the beat stuff every day, Jill. We're covering the debates. We're covering sort of the incremental things that really sort of spark and further awareness and engagement around civic discourse and dialogue that aren't going to draw a million eyeballs like some of the neat viral videos that are out there. So how do you all balance some of that? It's go for the big, juicy viral stuff versus the important incremental. Is there a balance or formula that can be applied?
I like to call viral the Hunger Games, because you might get a viral hit, but like, man, tomorrow you have to do it all over again. I will just tell you, in the last week, the two most read stories on our site were two pieces that our investigators did. One on this lack of caregivers for people who end up in the hospital and can't get out because they don't have anyone to care for them at home. And one series on these small tax districts throughout King County, where elected officials, in order for you to vote on them again, you have to request a ballot, and it's costing you money. And these stories we published, and they just stayed right there at the top of the charts, and they're still there. I can still see people reading deep into them. You can't be in it for the short haul, and I've learned that because I've been in the business for a while. It's always nice to get that viral hit, but then you go, oh good, I can breathe for a while. But you want your breathing to be steady, and you want to make sure that you're building an audience over time and you're building a reputation over time. So,
I've mentioned this on previous panels, but we every year kind of do a wrap up of like what of all the stories that were online on KOW.org and how they did and what went viral, what didn't, and all of that. And for the ones that were best performing, you can look at them, and they're just all over the place. There's no real through line. There's no real reason. You could just sit there and you scratch your head and wonder why these? And I think our online managing editor, Isolde Raftery, says it best, that often what's behind the best performing stories are the ones that are, it's the best storytelling. Like, it's not the topic, it's that they were, it's the best storytelling. And that's about, I think she's right, that's about all we've got. So quality journalism, and not necessarily having your goal always be for it to go viral. We use the Kano scale, which you can look up. It's like basic, performing, exciting, and up. And so how can we get some of our basic stories to get up to the performing category? How can we get performing to exciting? And really kind of up our numbers that way, rather than always aiming for the like, cat video.
And I would just say, of course, to answer this question, no, viral does not always mean that it's sound quality journalism, or that it's rigorous, or that it's impactful or meaningful in any way. The Venn diagram and its intersection is very tiny. But I would just say, I don't think that we don't have to pander to an audience to make something shareable or spreadable. I'm thinking really of like Sidney Brownstone's work, right? Incredibly impactful. And the reason why I think the pieces that we've made so post the election that are more political, that are more newsy, I think, that have done the best are things that people shared, but didn't just share. They also wrote commentary about it. We made a video about Black parents explaining the police to their children, for example. And in every single comment, people wrote something very personal and tagged their family members. Right? And so I think we can think about virality. In fact, we should just throw away the word virality. Like, it has an epidemiological meaning, and there's something more important about stuff that's shareable, the things that we want to talk about at the table with our friends and family, right? And that kind, that storytelling, that rigor, like all of that is what I think propels something to shareability.
We've got just time for one more question. There's a good one from the audience, so I want to build on it as a way we close out. And the question pertains to how the community who is interested, who is engaged, who wants to be intimately involved in understanding and perhaps even influencing decisions that are made at the professional journalism level, how do they become more connected? Do you all mind sharing one tip? Are there workshops? Are there things people can subscribe to? Are there online resources so that a community member can feel more closely connected or at least aware of how some of the internal machinations and the decisions come together? And perhaps this may lend to what they're hoping to elevate in terms of awareness for a community issue, I think is where this stems from.
I mean, I'd say there, for at least for KOW events, that's a really great place to engage. There's a widget on our homepage that says, what are you curious about? Where if you can ask us a question about our region, and if we find an interesting answer, we'll do a story on it. We also have our Battle Tactics for Your Sexist Workplace closed Facebook page if you want to try and join that. You could join the Primed Facebook page. Ask your questions, share a story. We, for Primed especially, have used a lot of the Facebook commenters and in Battle Tactics. We've used a lot of the people who've engaged us in the social media realm as sources in future episodes. So, or they've informed our reporting. So there are definitely a lot of ways to get involved.
Yeah, on this note, actually, like, I really want to write a manifesto for reading and writing comments. And I think, like, what would it mean if we all re-territorialize that space that we think of for trolls and for, like, the alt-right or whatever? And, like, fully, like, tried to realize what it meant to do the public sphere and have civic discourse in this space, what it would mean if we actually did a little bit of rigor ourselves as consumers to produce our own tiny response, right? And this, in this utopian vision in which we're all reading and writing the comments, and that place becomes actually an active, its own content, like, I think there could be something really exciting there. And I think we all need to think of ways of engaging our audience in a way that's more meaningful and substantial and acknowledges their collaboration with us. So I'd say that.
Wow, thank you. That was terrific. Before we conclude this session on the importance of local news, I wanted to briefly acknowledge someone quite special to many of us that I believe happens to be in the room this morning. From Crosscut, Joe Copeland, who is a senior editor for us. He's been an editor since the very earliest days of the news startup, informs us sadly that he'll be retiring next month. I wanted to express just how so lucky many of us have been to have had him in our midst. Before Crosscut, Joe was with the Seattle PI and the Everett Herald, and he's been an influence to literally hundreds of journalists throughout this region for many years. In talking with some of our editorial staff this week about me wanting to provide an acknowledgement, one of our senior editors provided. Joe's been a mentor and a sage to both reporters starting out and seasoned journalists. He is both a rock and a rock star, and Crosscut would not be what it is today without Joe's guiding presence. So, Mr. Copeland, thank you. We salute you. For the rest of you, thank you so much for taking time.
Thanks for listening to Crosscut Talks. This week's episode was recorded by Resty Bacall and produced by Sarah Bernard. Audio from the Crosscut Festival was recorded by Seattle Theater Group. You can subscribe to Crosscut Talks on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. For more on the Crosscut Talks podcast, go to crosscut.com/talks. And if you like the show, please review us on Apple Podcasts. It really helps other people find us. For the latest political, environmental, and culture news from the Pacific Northwest, visit crosscut.com. And remember to save the date for the next Crosscut Festival, May 1st and 2nd, 2020. To learn more, go to crosscut.com/festival. Crosscut Talks is a product of Cascade Public Media. I'm Mark Bumgarten. We'll be back next week with another episode.